So there's not going to be really a big fancy introduction because I was planning on just kind of editing this into a video itself.
Okay.
But I will have you introduce yourself and your book or any other works that you want to do or you want to plug just to kind of give a nice formal introduction. So, yeah, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm E. Paul Zarin. I'm a professor of neuroscience at the University of Victoria. My day job is helping people learn how to walk better after they've had stroke or spinal cord injury. And kind of my nighttime work and my alter ego has been writing science communication books using superheroes. I started that with training biology with Becoming Batman back in 2008. Then I wrote a book called Inventing Iron Man about amplifying biology with technology in 2011. And a book for kids in 2014, Project Superhero. And then this year just released Chasing Captain America, which is kind of completing the trilogy of now we look at what happens if you can change biology. Can you actually achieve Steve Rogers into Captain America?
Yeah. Something I noticed, a lot of really interesting themes throughout the book. I think there's a ton of talk about, you know, obviously the science of Captain America. Could we actually create someone who's super strong and super smart? But like kind of a general theme throughout the book kind of woven in there is and you touch on it a lot in the last section about the ethics of doing so, you know, like, you know, we go about from fixing injuries to then just saying, well, why not just do all these procedures on healthy humans and just enhance human biology as it is? And is that an okay thing? Is it something that we should be, you know, really excited about and really pushing forward with? So it's a lot of really interesting stuff there. And I know that you said kind of at the end of the section that when you were writing the book, you actually had a change of mind about that aspect of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I started off writing the book, I actually expected that I would end up sort of, you know, maybe we shouldn't do all these things that we actually have the power to do. But while I was writing the book, you know, and doing other research and interviewing tons of other scientists who are experts in all these different areas and talking to people and, you know, doing the back drop work that you do, the background research to write a book, I started wondering why I thought that. Like, what was that actually based on? And when I looked at it that way, I started to realize it wasn't based on anything, really. It was based on more thinking about life as sports, right? Like, you can't do biohacking if you're going to be in the Olympics because it's against the rules. There's a rule about, you know, taking anabolic steroids, or there's a rule about, you know, what kind of equipment you could use or something like that. But in life, there aren't rules like that. There's the rules that are involved in evolution, where you provide a stress to a biological system and it adapts. There's no rule about what kind of stress you can provide. It's just whatever the environment provides. So in life, there aren't any of these sort of rules in physiology about what's okay or not okay. And so I really started to question my thinking and really came to the conclusion that a lot of what I was thinking about wasn't really based on anything. And as a scientist, I don't really allow myself to have like just groundless feelings about things. I think I'd like to know what they're based on. And so I kind of came around to the idea that, you know, we ought to be looking at part of our evolution is actually our enhancing our own evolution. I mean, we are doing it to ourselves, you know, the changes we can make to our genome, the different drugs we could take, steroids and so on. But those are maybe part of the whole evolutionary concept anyway. And I also realized, you know, that a lot of my thinking was based on something about normal, whatever the heck normal is. And realize that, you know, people are on a continuum. We're not like normal or abnormal or above normal or under normal or with this kind of thing. We are on a continuum. So we can take all these ideas from science and biomedical engineering that were designed to help folks who had a disease, but they can also be used to help folks who are just trying to enhance their function or are trying to move to a different level.
Yeah, I mean, you use a lot of sports anecdotes in a book, you know, for nerds, which was very entertaining. No, but like, I really like this idea that something you touched on in one of the later chapters about how really it's one of those things that the constantly evolving technology is something that we can't stop. It's already in progress. So we have to think about what's going to happen in the future. We have that responsibility to figure out what are we going to do with it. Are we going to make sure that it's in the hands of the right people? You talk in a couple places about the dangers of having the wealthy almost monopolize certain technologies and, you know, create, you know, have them be immortal while, you know, people who are lower class die off. And that's not great, ideally.
No.
Yeah. So there's a lot of discussions about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key things about all of my what I would call science communication writing, you know, where I'm trying to use superheroes and popular culture as a way to bridge the gap that sometimes exists between academics, you know, at a university and the general public, it's empowerment through knowledge. You know, I'm trying to share knowledge as widely as I can. And it's really important, the kind of knowledge I'm trying to share, even though I'm doing it in a fun kind of you know, grounded in a comic book sort of metaphor, which is engaging and interesting and has some fun elements. It can be scary too. But the point is, I'm trying to get that message out there because, like you're saying, we're only going to become more reliant on science and technology. It's only going to become more integrated in our daily life and in our bodies. And I think people need to know about what we're able to do, what it might mean. So, because we're all part of the same society and we need to come up with ideas about, hey, you know what? We're okay if we think about enhancing humans from this point to this point. But beyond that, we're not cool with that. And or maybe we are. I mean, that's not for me to decide. That's for our society to decide. And I think you get that way by giving people the opportunity to learn about stuff they might not normally come across. You know, somebody who picks up Chasing Captain America is going to learn about CRISPR and gene editing. Maybe they already knew about that. I don't know. But probably not. But now they're learning a bit about it. So when they read something in the newspaper, they see something on Twitter, they understand there's some legislation that's going to be passed about something. They're like, hey, wait a minute. I know about that a little bit. I'm not okay with that. Or, hey, I think I should be advocating for that because that'll help with this or that or the next thing. It's about having knowledge, right? And using that so that we can better our societies as we go forward.
Absolutely. And you touch on a vast array of different things in here, things like, you know, you're talking about CRISPR, you touch on epigenetics, which is one of my favorite things to talk about. There's a bunch of really interesting experiments that you also brought to light that I can't stop thinking about. So I just want to briefly just talk on a couple of those that caught my eye. In a section where you were discussing having the possibility of creating, you know, super musculature in Captain America, you talk about myostatin. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And how it kind of keeps muscles within like the range of what a normal human should be. It kind of stops them from growing too much. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you talk about an experiment and you set it up in one of my favorite sentences I've ever read, which is, this brings us to the subject of super strong monkeys. And I was like, all right, I'm in. I got to know what happens next. But you talk about this and through an experiment, these monkeys had their muscles grew by like 25%. Like that's...
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been known for a long time that you could have these weird sort of spontaneously occurring gene deletions and you'd have a myostatin gene deletion. And it's known in like, in the cattle industry where they get these things called double muscled cattle where they're super muscular. Like they look like literally cows on steroids. If you see pictures of these things and they look like that because their muscles are 25 to 30% bigger than normal because they're lacking the gene myostatin, which is in a category of genes called chalones, which regulate the size of different things. They're the ones that go haywire when you get the giant pumpkin. That's the same thing where that you've lost the regulation of what's a normal size pumpkin and you lose the governor and the thing just grows to ginormous sizes. That's what happens in those double-muscled cattle. And you know, there's some examples of folks who've done this deliberately with different dog breeds, you know, interbreeding to get this kind of thing. And there's been a couple of examples in the medical literature of folks where this has spontaneously happened in humans as well. A lot of the times we hear about people with crazy strength, and wow, that person might have the myostatin gene deletion. But the critical thing here about the super strong monkeys is these folks in Ohio, they took monkeys that weren't with the gene deletion. They didn't look like steroid monkeys. They looked like normal monkeys. But what they did was they put an injection that wound up using an interaction of another gene that regulates something called follistatin, which interacts with myostatin. So one's kind of like a gatekeeper, and if you knock out the one, it affects the other. And what they did was they took the brakes off. That regulation of the muscle size is now knocked out in those monkeys. And very rapidly, they got stronger. So first of all, it worked to do this sort of effect in the monkeys. Second of all, they got stronger, and 20%, 30% increase in strength is a lot when you think about it. It's just happening pretty quickly, and you're not doing a whole bunch of training. Imagine putting the training on top of that. Imagine adding steroids to that for really enhanced effects. But the point was, these things actually work, where you could go and say, hey, we know this gene regulates this. We know this other gene interacts with it. What if we delete this one? What if we insert this one? Will it knock this out? And this was the proof of principle that you could actually make this happen on purpose, which I used in the book to illustrate. Here's the kind of power we have at our fingertips, literally now, to go in and change what it means to be a biologically functioning human, to kind of change the range. And that's mind-blowing, that experiment. And, you know, I talked about super strong monkeys and also gave my sort of horror story of the Wizard of Oz as a child, being frightened of the flying winged monkeys. So hopefully they don't get the myostatin gene deletion. But anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man. And then from there, you also talk about this is probably the experiment that stuck out the most to me. It was the one about mental acuity in mice where... Yeah. You want to just talk about it? Because you get
yeah, I know the one
I
you're
do.
Talking yeah, about. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this was one of the most mind-blowing experiments I've literally, as a neuroscientist, and I've been doing neuroscience for several decades. Yeah, this was interesting. This group wanted to look at whether they could enhance basically what we might call the intelligence of mice. And now mouse intelligence, they don't write a test, obviously, but they like we'd have an IQ test or something. But it's how fast they learn, you know, a maze or a maze learning or returning to find some food pellets, all these kinds of things. Those are kind of behavioral tests that they do in mice. And we know that there's these cells in our brains. But people always think about what's in your brain, think of neurons. Those are kind of the processing cells. But there's many, many more, in addition to those 100 billion neurons you have in your brain, in your cortex, cerebral cortex, you also have a whole bunch of these other cells called microglia, which people thought they were like scaffolding or support cells, but in fact are really important for physiological functioning. In particular, they do this thing with calcium, and calcium ions regulate, so please drink your milk, know that they regulate the speed at which your neurons function. They can help move ions around, basically, and move them in a way that helps support the activity of the neurons. Now, in a human, those cells work about three times as fast as in the mouse. And probably most readers, when they read that, were disappointed to find out their brains were only functioning three times faster. That's not really what that means, but it means these cells are three times as fast, which is a lot in biological terms. What they wanted to know was, could we take those support cells from a human, put it in the brain of a mouse? First of all, would it live there? Second of all, would it do anything? And lastly, how long would it work? Like, would it just be die after a little while? So they did a couple of experiments over several years. But what they found was they put these cells in, injected these sort of what they call embryological progenitor cells, so a kind of stem cell eventually is what they use, but they use a variety of different methods. But in any case, put them into the brain of the mouse and let the mouse recover, and then have a batch of mice which had this kind of chimeric enhancement where they're now kind of a multi-species thing because they got human tissue in them. And then test them at all these behavioral things and find out whether the mice that had the brain cells from humans in them actually were smarter. And yeah, they were. They totally crushed the other mice. They were a lot faster at learning. They retained things more. They were super smart mice. And this effect lasted for a long time. And in fact, they did a couple of follow-up experiments where they found that even a year later, not only were those cells still active, but they'd been multiplying and growing in the mouse brain, so that there were many, many more cells present now than they expected to find, which meant that, hey, this thing actually worked to put brain cells from another animal to literally create a chimera, an animal composed of genetic material from two different species, into the mouse brain, make them supercharged, and make them super smart. And, having just gone to see Avengers Infinity War and seeing Rocket Raccoon again, that's basically Rocket Raccoon's backstory, right? Genetically yeah. modified raccoon. And this was basically what I was thinking about when I was writing that piece was, here's an example of how this could really work.
Yeah. And then if that wasn't enough for me, the thing that got me was, you know, after the experiment, they were seeing how long it would last. And you wrote that the human cells pretty much overtook the mouse brain cells, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, they basically took over that part of the brain for memory enhancement and formation. And that was not expected.
No.
Typically, this idea of transplanting tissue goes way back. You know, back, it used to be and still is a treatment for some folks with Parkinson's, where you can take fetal tissue and you can transplant, you know, within a species into the brain and help for a while. But the problem is that it doesn't last. It's kind of like you plant stuff in your garden, but it just doesn't take. It sort of grows for a while and then dies. That's normally what happens. But when using these sort of stem cell approaches, seems to be working a lot better. And in fact, that was ridiculous when I read that follow-up study. Like, I was already kind of blown away with the first kind of things they did. And then that, which was just like, wow, it works so well that it's actually exceeded all possible expectations on what could happen. Which I use kind of to highlight, too, the power of all these things. You know, a lot of these things work better than we think they will sometimes. So yeah. We need to have a good idea what we're doing.
Exactly. And I think really early on, kind of as a starting thought to go through the book, you talk about this idea of it's not enough just to enhance one part of the body, because it might throw off balance everything else. You have to update all of it if you really want a chance for any of these enhancements to stick around. And you know, with Captain America specifically, in the comics and in the movies, he's just, you know, he goes into like a pod and then he comes out all nice. But yeah. In reality, as of where we are now, it would kind of like be doing one piece at a time, which might not end up in the best result.
Yeah, and you got to realize all these things are kind of a really finely balanced kind of machine analogy, where you've got all these things working together. They all regulate each other. There's multiple overlapping physiological loops and everything. You start messing around with one thing, it's hard to know about the adaptations and all the other pathways. So, yeah, you also need to be updating this guy all the time. So Steve Rogers would probably need to be coming back for maintenance every week, back to the lab, wherever this happened, to get a tune-up. To find out how things are out of whack, what can be adjusted, you know, what levels of what need to be altered, because it would be an ongoing thing. It would be almost impossible to arrive at something that's self-sustaining right away. It would need to be adapted and tweaked all the time.
Yeah. And it's, I don't want to take up too much of your time. This has already been awesome and really helpful for me. Is there anything that stands out to you specifically, other than the mice thing, because that one really got me? But is there anything that, in the process of researching and writing, that either really stood out to you or was something that you really wanted to get across in the book in any way?
Yeah, and the main thing is getting people thinking about these ideas, getting people thinking about what are we okay with enhancing? Because this... I got to admit, too often in science, stuff happens, then we think about what it means after. And that happens regardless of how you plan, because you're going to discover things by accident. That's the whole point of discovery. You can't always plan to discover something. You discover things because of your efforts. But when we know we're pointed in a certain direction, where some of these experiments are going to yield information on how viable gene deletions might be in humans, enhanced performance, I want people thinking about this in advance of when it actually is a full procedure available, because we need to plan in advance. These things are going to happen. I'm not saying even necessarily that they must happen, but they will, because that's the way things work. We have advances in things happening all the time. So we need to be at a place where folks are thinking about what it means and prepared to discuss things and have input. I give a test case in the book about where we'd actually apply all this stuff, because I say, regardless of what we might do on Earth, basically, if we're going to send folks to Mars and other planets, we're going to have to do all this, I think. They would be our test pilots, literally, for human enhancement, because they need the best chance to arrive at a harsh environment pre-adapted or pre-evolved. And I think that's a discussion we have to have, too. And the more people that read stuff like this, I think the better prepared they are to be part of that discussion. I hope other people get engaged in these things too, because this is our societies around the world. This is our world. This is our species. we all have a take in this and a stake in it. So we need to be involved in the process and setting limits of what is okay and what isn't okay.
Yeah. What does it really mean to be human? Can we extend beyond the limits that we already know? Are we still human at that point? I don't know. A lot of big questions. But I appreciate this book. I appreciate your other works as well. Many years ago, a friend gave me Becoming Batman, and that's when I was like, this is awesome. So I think I've used that in a few videos for sure. And I can't wait to kind of put all this together, and I want to send you a link whenever it's up. I don't know when it's going to be up, but just thank you so much for helping.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is going to be really awesome. I love doing these interviews, and I love talking with people who are much smarter than I am, because it makes me seem smarter by proximity, which I appreciate.
It's just a different kind of smart, right?
Yeah. that's right? What I tell myself, for sure.
Yeah, no, that's true, though.
Yeah.
Continuum, remember? Yeah.
That's right. Fantastic. Well, hey, thanks so much.
Yeah.
And have a good day.
You too.
Yeah. All right. See you later.
Thank you for your interest.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. Oh.